I did.
Then neither of them will ever be happier than the other, not the one who seizes the tyranny unjustly, nor the one who's punished for trying, since between two wretched men, neither can be happier than the other. But the one who escapes and becomes tyrant is more wretched. Why are you laughing, Polus? Is this another kind of refutation, when someone makes a claim, to laugh at it instead of refuting it?
Don't you think you've already been refuted, Socrates, when you say things nobody on earth would agree to? Just ask any of these men here.
Polus, I'm no politician. Last year, when I was chosen by lot to sit on the council, and my tribe held the presidency and it fell to me to call for a vote, I made everyone laugh because I didn't know how to conduct it properly. So don't ask me now to poll the people present either. Instead, if you have no better proof than the kind I was just describing, hand the argument over to me for a turn, and let me try the kind of proof I think is called for. Because I know how to produce one witness for whatever I claim, the very man I'm arguing with, and I let the majority go their way, and I know how to take one man's vote, though I don't even converse with the majority. So see whether you're willing to take your turn giving proof by answering my questions. I believe that you and I and everyone else consider doing wrong worse than suffering it, and escaping punishment worse than being punished.
And I believe nothing of the sort, not for myself, not for anyone else. Would you rather suffer wrong than do it?
Yes, and so would you, and so would everyone else.
Far from it, not I, not you, not anyone.
Then won't you answer?
I certainly will. I'm curious to hear what you'll say.
Tell me then, so you'll know, as if I were asking you from the beginning. Which seems to you worse, Polus, doing wrong or suffering it?
Suffering it, in my view.
And which is more shameful, doing wrong or suffering it? Answer.
Doing wrong.
And isn't the more shameful also the worse, if it's more shameful?
Not at all.
I see. Apparently you don't think the fine and the good are the same thing, nor the bad and the shameful.
No, I don't.
Well, what about this? When you call things fine, bodies, colors, shapes, sounds, ways of life, do you call them fine without reference to anything? Take fine bodies first. Don't you call them fine either in respect of their usefulness, for whatever purpose each is useful, or in respect of some pleasure, if they give pleasure to those who look at them as they look? Can you name anything about bodily beauty apart from these?
I can't.
And don't you likewise call everything else fine, shapes and colors too, either because of some pleasure or some benefit or both?
I do.
And the same goes for sound and everything in music?
Yes.
And surely laws and ways of life aren't outside this either. Things are called fine because they're beneficial or pleasant or both.
I don't think so, no.
And isn't the beauty of studies the same way?
Certainly, and you're defining it well now, Socrates, marking off the fine by pleasure and benefit.
And the shameful by their opposites, then pain and harm.
Necessarily.
So whenever, of two fine things, one is finer than the other, it's finer by exceeding the other in one of these, pleasure or benefit or both.
Certainly.
And whenever, of two shameful things, one is more shameful, it will be more shameful by exceeding in pain or in harm. Isn't that necessary, too?
Yes.
Well then, how did we put it just now about doing wrong and suffering it? Didn't you say that suffering wrong is worse, but doing wrong is more shameful?
I did.
So if doing wrong is more shameful than suffering it, then it must be either more painful and more shameful by an excess of pain, or more shameful by an excess of harm, or both. Isn't that necessary too?
Of course.
Then first let's examine whether doing wrong exceeds suffering it in pain, whether wrongdoers feel more pain than those who are wronged.
Not at all, Socrates, not that.
Then it doesn't exceed in pain.
No, it doesn't.
and if not in pain, then it can't exceed in both.
Apparently not.
So it's left with the other one.
Yes.
With harm.
So it seems.
So doing wrong, exceeding in harm, would be worse than suffering it.
Clearly so.
Now didn't most people, and you as well, agree earlier that doing wrong is more shameful than suffering it?
Yes.
And now it's turned out to be worse.
So it seems.
Would you then choose the worse and more shameful over the less so? Don't shrink from answering, Polis. You won't be harmed by it. Just submit nobly to the argument as you would to a doctor, and say yes or no to what I ask.
No, I wouldn't choose it, Socrates.
Would anyone else?
Not on this reasoning, I don't think.
So what I was saying was true, that neither I nor you nor anyone else would choose to do wrong rather than suffer it, since it turns out to be worse.
So it appears.
You see then, Polis, when one proof is set beside the other, they're nothing alike, while everyone else agrees with you except me. For my part, you alone are enough for me, agreeing and testifying, and I take your single vote and let the others go their way. Let's leave that matter as it stands, then, and turn to the second point we disputed, whether a wrongdoer paying the penalty is the greatest of evils, as you supposed, or whether not paying it is greater still, as I supposed. Let's look at it this way. Do you call paying the penalty and being justly punished for wrongdoing the same thing?
I do.
Can you say that whatever is just isn't also fine, insofar as it's just? Think it over and tell me.
It does seem so to me, Socrates.
Then consider this too. If someone does something, isn't there necessarily something that has it done to it by the one doing it?
I think so.
And does it undergo just what the doer does, and in the same manner as the doer does it? I mean something like this. If someone strikes, must something be struck?
Necessarily.
And if the striker strikes hard or fast, the thing struck is struck in that same way?
Yes.
So the thing struck undergoes whatever sort of experience the striker inflicts?
Certainly.
And if someone burns something, must something be burned?
Of course.
And if he burns it intensely or painfully, the thing burned is burned just as the burner burns it?
Certainly.
And the same reasoning holds if someone cuts something, something is cut?
Yes.
And if the cut is large or deep or painful, the thing cut suffers a cut of just the kind the cutter makes?
It appears so.
In short, then, see whether you agree with what I was just saying about all cases. Whatever sort of thing the doer does, the sufferer suffers a like thing.
I agree.
Given this agreement, is paying a penalty a case of suffering something or doing something?
It must be suffering, Socrates.
And at the hands of someone doing something?
Of course, the one inflicting punishment.
And the one who punishes correctly punishes justly.
Yes.
Doing just things then, or not?
Just things.
So the one being punished, in paying the penalty, suffers what is just.
So it appears.
And we've agreed that just things are fine.
Certainly.
Then of these two, one does what is fine and the other, the one being punished, suffers it.
Yes.
So if they're fine things, they're good things, because they're either pleasant or beneficial.
Necessarily.
So the person who pays the penalty experiences something good.
So it seems.
He's benefited then.
Yes.
Benefited in the way I mean. His soul becomes better if he's punished justly.
That's likely.
So the one paying the penalty is rid of a vice in his soul.
Yes.
Is he then rid of the greatest evil? Look at it this way. In managing one's money, do you see any vice other than poverty?
No, just poverty.
And in the condition of the body, would you say the vice there is weakness, disease, deformity, and the like?
I would.
And don't you think there's some corresponding badness in the soul, too?
Of course.
And don't you call that injustice, ignorance, cowardice, and so on?
Certainly.
So with money, body, and soul, three things you've named three kinds of badness: poverty, disease, injustice.
Yes.
Now which of these forms of badness is the most shameful? Isn't it injustice, the soul's badness generally?
By far.
And if it's the most shameful, is it also the worst?
What do you mean by that, Socrates?
Like this. Whatever is most shameful is always so because it causes the greatest pain, or the greatest harm, or both. That follows from what we agreed earlier.
Certainly.
And we just agreed that injustice, and badness of soul generally, is the most shameful thing.
We did agree to that.
So it's the most shameful either because it's the most painful and exceeds in pain, or because it exceeds in harm, or both?
Necessarily.
Then is being unjust, undisciplined, cowardly, and ignorant more painful than being poor or sick?
It doesn't seem so to me, Socrates, not on those grounds.
So it must be some extraordinary harm, some astonishing evil surpassing everything else, that makes the soul's badness the most shameful of all things, since it isn't through pain, as you yourself say.
So it appears.
But surely, whatever exceeds in the greatest harm would be the greatest evil there is.
Yes.
So injustice, lack of self-control, and the soul's other badness are the greatest evil there is.
So it appears.
Now what skill relieves poverty? Isn't it money-making?
Yes.
And what relieves disease? Isn't it medicine?
Necessarily.
And what relieves badness and injustice? If you can't answer easily, look at it this way. Where and to whom do we take people who are sick in body?
To doctors, Socrates.
And where do we take people who act unjustly and without self-control?
You mean to the judges.
To pay a penalty, you mean?
Yes.
And don't those who punish correctly do so by applying a kind of justice?
Clearly.
So money-making relieves poverty, medicine relieves disease, and justice relieves lack of self-control and injustice.
So it appears.
Now which of these is the finest?
Finest in what sense?
Money-making, medicine, justice.
Justice is far superior, Socrates.
And doesn't whatever is finest produce the most pleasure, or the most benefit, or both, since it's the finest?
Yes.
Is being treated by a doctor pleasant, then? Do patients enjoy it?
I don't think so.
But it is beneficial, isn't it?
Yes.
Because one is rid of a great evil, so it's worthwhile to endure the pain in order to be healthy.
Of course.
So as far as the body goes, would a person be happiest being treated by a doctor, or by never being sick in the first place?
Clearly by never being sick.
Because happiness, it seems, isn't being rid of an evil, but never having had it at all.
That's right.
Now, of two people who have some evil, either in body or in soul, which is more wretched, the one who gets treated and is rid of the evil, or the one who isn't treated and keeps it?
It seems to me the one who isn't treated.
And wasn't paying the penalty a release from the greatest evil, badness itself?
It was.
Because justice disciplines people and makes them more just. It's a kind of medicine for badness.
Yes.
So the happiest person is the one with no vice in his soul, since that was shown to be the greatest of evils.
Clearly.
and second happiest, I suppose, is the one who is rid of it.
So it seems.
And that's the person who is admonished, rebuked, and pays the penalty.
Yes.
So the person who lives worst is the one who has injustice and is never rid of it.
So it appears.
And isn't this the very person who, by committing the greatest injustices and using injustice to the fullest, manages to avoid being admonished, punished, or made to pay any penalty, just as you say Archelaus has arranged for himself, and other tyrants, orators, and men of power?
So it seems.
Because these men, my excellent friend, have more or less achieved the same thing as someone gripped by the worst diseases who manages to avoid paying the doctors any penalty for his bodily faults and avoids treatment altogether, afraid like a child of the burning and cutting, because it's painful. Don't you think it's like that?
I do.
Not understanding, it seems, what health and bodily excellence really are. Because, from what we've now agreed, it looks like those who escape punishment do something similar, polis. They see the pain of it clearly enough, but they're blind to the benefit, not realizing how much more wretched it is to live with an unhealthy soul than an unhealthy body, a soul that's rotten, unjust, and impious. That's why they do everything they can to avoid paying the penalty and being freed from the greatest evil, piling up money and friends, and making themselves as persuasive speakers as possible. But if what we've agreed is true, Polis, do you see what follows from the argument? Or shall we work it out together?
If you think so.
Doesn't it follow that injustice, acting unjustly, is the greatest evil?
So it appears.
And we also showed that paying the penalty is the release from that evil.
It seems so.
And not paying it means the evil remains.
Yes.
So acting unjustly is the second worst thing in terms of magnitude. But acting unjustly and not paying the penalty is by nature the worst and greatest of all evils.
So it seems.
Now wasn't this exactly the point we were disputing? My friend, you calling Archelaus happy, a man who commits the greatest injustices and pays no penalty at all, while I hold the opposite, that whoever, Archelaus or anyone else, acts unjustly without paying the penalty deserves to be more wretched than everyone else, and that the wrongdoer is always more wretched than the wronged, and the one who escapes punishment more wretched than the one who is punished. Isn't that what I was saying?
Yes.
And hasn't it now been shown that this was true?
So it appears.
Very well. If all this is true, Polis, what great use is oratory then? From what we've now agreed, a person must above all guard himself against acting unjustly, knowing that this will bring him evil enough. Isn't that so?
Certainly.
And if he does act unjustly, either himself or anyone he cares about, he should go voluntarily, as quickly as possible, to wherever he'll be made to pay the penalty, to the judge as if to a doctor, eager to keep the sickness of injustice from festering in the soul and becoming incurable over time. Isn't that what we must say, Polis, if our earlier agreements still stand? Doesn't this necessarily follow from them and nothing else?
Well, what else could we say, Socrates?
So oratory is of no use to us, Polis, for defending one's own injustice, or that of one's parents, friends, children, or country when it acts unjustly. Unless someone takes the opposite view, that one should accuse oneself first of all, then one's family and anyone else among one's friends who happens to act unjustly, and not hide the wrongdoing but bring it into the open, so that the penalty may be paid and the soul restored to health. That one should force oneself and others not to shrink back, but to offer oneself bravely, eyes shut, as if to the doctor's knife and cautery, pursuing the good and the fine without weighing the pain, offering oneself for a beating if the wrongdoing deserves a beating, for imprisonment if it deserves imprisonment, paying a fine if that's due, accepting exile if that's due, accepting death if that's due, being the first to accuse himself and his own family, and using oratory for this very purpose. So that once the injustices are exposed, people may be freed from the greatest evil, injustice itself. Shall we say this polis or not?
It seems strange to me, Socrates, though perhaps it agrees with what we said before.
Then either we must undo those earlier agreements, or this conclusion must follow.
Yes, that's how it stands.
And conversely, if one must do harm to someone, an enemy or anyone else, provided one hasn't been wronged by that enemy oneself, for that must be guarded against. But if the enemy has wronged someone else, then every effort should be made, in word and deed, to keep him from paying the penalty or ever coming before the judge. And if he does come, one should contrive some way for the enemy to escape and avoid paying the penalty, if he's stolen a great deal of gold, to let him keep it and spend it, unjustly and godlessly, on himself and his own. And if he's done something deserving death, to make sure he doesn't die, best of all never, letting him live on forever in his wickedness, but failing that, letting him live as long as possible in that condition. For such purposes, polis, oratory seems useful to me. For someone who doesn't intend to act unjustly, it doesn't seem to me to have much use, if indeed it has any use at all, since none has appeared in our discussion so far.
Tell me, Chaerephon, is Socrates serious about this, or is he joking?
To me, Callicles, he seems extraordinarily serious, but there's nothing like asking him yourself.
By the gods, that's just what I want to do. Tell me, Socrates, are we to take you as serious right now, or joking? Because if you're serious, and what you're saying happens to be true, then wouldn't our whole human life be turned upside down, and everything we do be the opposite of what we should do?
Callicles, if human beings didn't each experience some feeling, some one thing, some another, or some the same thing as others, but instead each of us had some private experience all our own that no one else shared, it wouldn't be easy to make our own feeling clear to someone else. I say this because I notice that you and I happen right now to be experiencing the same thing. Each of us is in love, twice over, I with Alcibiades, son of Clinias and with philosophy, and you with two loves as well, the Athenian people and the son of Pyrilamps. And I notice that you, clever as you are, can't contradict whatever your beloved says or however he says he feels. You keep shifting back and forth. In the assembly, if you say something and the Athenian people disagree, you change your position and say what they want to hear. And you've experienced the same sort of thing with that handsome young man, the son of Pyrilamps. You can't bring yourself to oppose whatever your darling thinks and says. And so, if someone were amazed at the strange things you say for his sake and objected, you'd tell him if you wanted to speak the truth that unless somebody stops your darling from saying such things, you'll never stop saying them yourself either. Well, you should expect to hear the same sort of thing from me now. Don't be surprised that I say what I say, blame philosophy instead, my own darling, and make her stop saying these things. She's the one who says, dear friend, what you're hearing from me right now, and she's a far less fickle darling than the other one. That son of Clanius changes his tune from one moment to the next, but philosophy always says the same things, and what she says is exactly what's amazing you now, and you were there yourself when it was said. So either refute her show, as I was just saying, that doing wrong and getting away with it unpunished is not the worst of all evils, or, if you leave that unrefuted, then by the dog, the god of the Egyptians, Callicles will not agree with you, Callicles, but will be out of tune with himself his whole life long. And yet I, for my part, my good man, would rather have my lyre out of tune and jangling, or a chorus I was directing sound like that. And I would rather practically the whole human race disagreed with me and contradicted me, than that I, a single individual, should be out of harmony with myself and contradict myself.
Socrates, you seem to be indulging yourself in speeches like some kind of true crowd pleaser. And that's exactly what you're doing now, making a speech to the crowd, now that Polus has suffered the very thing he accused you of doing to Gorgias. He said, I think, that when you asked Gorgias whether, if someone came to him wanting to learn rhetoric without already knowing what's just, Gorgias would teach him. Gorgias, out of shame, said he would teach him, because of people's habit of getting angry if you say you won't, and that because of this admission he was forced to contradict himself, which is exactly what you enjoy. And you laughed at him then, rightly, I thought, but now he's gone, and suffered the very same thing himself. And for my part, I don't much admire Polus for this, because he conceded to you that doing wrong is more shameful than suffering it, for it was from this very admission that he in turn got tripped up in the argument by you and had his mouth shut, too ashamed to say what he really thought. Because in truth, Socrates, this pursuit of yours, which you call the pursuit of truth, leads to vulgar, crowd-pleasing conclusions, things that are not fine by nature, but only by convention. And these two, nature and convention, are for the most part opposed to one another. So, if a person feels ashamed and doesn't dare say what he really thinks, he's forced to contradict himself. And this is exactly the clever trick you've noticed and exploit in your arguments. If someone speaks according to convention, you cross-examine him according to nature. And if he speaks according to nature, you cross-examine him according to convention. That's just what happened a moment ago in the case of doing wrong and suffering wrong. When Polus said that doing wrong was more shameful according to convention, you pursued that claim according to nature. For by nature, everything that is worse is also more shameful, and suffering wrong is worse, but by convention, doing wrong is more shameful. In fact, suffering wrong isn't even something that happens to a real man at all, it's the condition of some slave, for whom it's better to be dead than alive, who, when he's wronged and abused, can't defend himself or anyone else he cares about. No, I think the people who make the laws are the weak, the many. It's with themselves and their own advantage in mind that they make their laws and hand out their praise and their blame, and to frighten the stronger sort of men, the ones capable of getting more, so that these won't get more than they do. They say that getting more than one's share is shameful and unjust, and that this is what doing wrong means, seeking to have more than others. Because I think they're quite happy to have an equal share themselves, being the inferior ones. That's why by convention seeking to have more than the majority is called unjust and shameful, and they call it doing wrong, but nature itself, I think, declares that it's just for the better man to have more than the worse, and the more capable more than the less capable. And this is shown to be so in many places. Among the other animals, and among whole cities and races of men, it's judged just in just this way, that the stronger rule the weaker and have the greater share. For what kind of justice did Xerxes rely on when he marched against Greece, or his father when he marched against the Scythians? One could mention countless other examples like these. No, I believe these men act according to the nature of justice, yes, by Zeus, according to the law of nature, though perhaps not according to that law which we ourselves lay down. When we mold the best and strongest among us, taking them from childhood, like lion cubs, and with our chants and spells we enslave them, telling them that one must have an equal share, and that this is what's fine and just. But if a man is born with a nature strong enough, I believe he'll shake all this off, burst through it, escape. He'll trample underfoot our documents and tricks and incantations and all our laws that go against nature. The slave will rise up and be revealed as our master, and there the justice of nature will blaze forth. And I think Pindar shows exactly what I'm saying in that song where he says, "Law, the king of all, of mortals and immortals," and this law, he says, carries out the utmost violence with a hand held highest, and I judge it so by the deeds of Heracles, since without paying for them, it goes something like that. I don't know the song by heart. He means that Heracles drove off Geryon's cattle without buying them, and without Geryon giving them, because this is what's just by nature. That cattle and all other possessions belong to the better and stronger man, taken from the worse and weaker. Well, that's how the truth of the matter stands, and you'll see it too, if you finally give up philosophy and turn to greater things. Philosophy, Socrates, is a charming thing if one takes it up in moderation at the right age, but if one spends more time at it than one should, it ruins a man. Even if someone is very gifted by nature, if he goes on philosophizing well past his youth, he's bound to end up ignorant of everything a man needs to know if he's going to be admirable and respected. Such people end up ignorant of the laws that govern their city, ignorant of the kind of speech one must use in dealing with people in matters of business, whether private or public, ignorant of human pleasures and desires, and in short, entirely ignorant of human character. So when they go into some private or public activity, they become laughingstocks, just as, I imagine, statesmen become laughingstocks when they wander into your kind of discussions and arguments. For what happens is just what Euripides says: each man shines in the field where he does best, and rushes toward that, giving the greater part of his day to just this, wherever he happens to be at his best, but wherever he's weak, that's what he flees and runs down, while he praises the other thing, out of goodwill toward himself, thinking that in this way he's praising himself. No, I believe the most correct course is to have a share of both. It's fine to take part in philosophy as far as education goes, and there's nothing shameful in a young man philosophizing. But when a man who's already getting on in years still goes on philosophizing, the thing becomes ridiculous, Socrates, and I have exactly the same reaction to philosophers as I do to people who lisp and play childish games. When I see a small child, for whom it's still appropriate to talk that way, lisping and playing, I'm delighted it seems charming to me, and free-spirited, and fitting for the child's age. But when I hear a small child speaking clearly and precisely, it strikes me as something harsh, it grates on my ears, and seems to me somehow slavish. But when one hears a grown man lisping, or sees him playing childish games, it looks ridiculous, unmanly, deserving a beating. Well, that's exactly how I feel about people who philosophize. When I see philosophy in a young boy, I admire it. It seems fitting to me, and I think such a person shows some breeding, while the one who doesn't philosophize seems to me unfree, someone who will never think himself worthy of anything fine or noble. But when I see an older man still philosophizing, still not giving it up, that man seems to me to need a beating already, Socrates. As I was just saying, such a person, however naturally gifted, is bound to become unmanly, avoiding the center of the city and the marketplaces where, as the poet says, men become distinguished, and instead spend the rest of his life hiding away, whispering in a corner with three or four boys, never uttering anything free and grand and worthy. As for me, Socrates, I feel rather friendly toward you, so I think I must be in much the same position now as Zethus was toward Amphion in the play of Euripides that I mentioned before. Yes, the same sort of thing occurs to me to say to you as Zethus said to his brother, that you neglect, Socrates, what you ought to be attending to, and you take a soul so naturally noble and dress it up in a boyish disguise. You'd be no use framing an argument correctly in a court of law, nor could you come up with anything plausible and persuasive, nor make any bold proposal on someone else's behalf. And yet, my dear Socrates, and don't be offended with me, I say this out of goodwill toward you. Doesn't it seem shameful to you to be in the condition I think you're in, and the others who keep pushing further and further into philosophy? As things stand, if someone seized you, or anyone else like you, and dragged you off to prison, claiming you'd done wrong when you'd done nothing of the kind, you know you wouldn't have the first idea what to do with yourself. You'd get dizzy and stand there gaping, with nothing to say. And then, when you came up before the court, facing some thoroughly worthless and contemptible accuser, you'd be put to death, if he chose to ask for the death penalty. And yet how can this be wise, Socrates, that a skill takes a naturally gifted man and makes him worse, unable to help himself or save himself or anyone else from the greatest dangers, stripped of all his property by his enemies, living, quite literally, without any honor in his city. Such a man, if I may put it rather crudely, can be slapped across the face with impunity. No, my good man, listen to me. Stop your refutations, practice the graceful conduct of real affairs, and practice whatever will make you look intelligent, leaving these clever little exercises to others, call them foolishness or nonsense, whichever you like, things that will leave you living in an empty house. Don't envy men who spend their time on these small refutations, but rather those who have a good life, a good reputation, and many other good things.
If it happened, Callicles, that my soul were made of gold, don't you think I'd be glad to find one of those stones they use to test gold, the very best one, so that, when I brought my soul to it, if it agreed that my soul had been well cared for, I would know for certain that I was in good condition and needed no other test.
Why do you ask this, Socrates?
I'll tell you. I think that in meeting you just now, I've met with exactly such a stroke of luck.
How so?
I know well that if you agree with me about what my own soul believes, then that agreement is the truth itself. Because I've noticed that anyone who's going to test properly whether a soul is living rightly or not needs to have three things, all of which you have: knowledge, goodwill, and frankness. Many people I meet can't test me because they aren't wise the way you are. Others are wise, but they won't tell me the truth because they don't care about me the way you do. As for our two foreign friends here, Gorgias and Polus, they're wise and they're fond of me, but they're a bit short on frankness and more bashful than they need to be. And why wouldn't they be? They've reached such a pitch of bashfulness that shame drives each of them, in front of a large crowd, to contradict himself, and about the most important matters, too. But you have all the things the others lack. You're well enough educated, as many an Athenian would say, and you're well disposed toward me. What's my evidence? I'll tell you. I know, Callicles, that you four have formed a partnership in wisdom. You, Tisander of Aphidne, Andron son of Androtion, and Gnosticides of Chalargus. And I once overheard you deliberating about how far one ought to pursue wisdom, and I know that the view that won out among you was this: don't be too eager to philosophize down to the last precision, but be careful, you urged one another, not to ruin yourselves by becoming wiser than you need to be. So when I hear you giving me the very same advice you give your closest companions, that's evidence enough for me that you truly are well disposed toward me, and that you're the sort of person who can speak frankly and isn't ashamed too. You say so yourself, and the speech you gave a moment ago bears you out. So here's how things clearly stand on this matter. Whatever you agree to with me in our discussion will have been tested thoroughly enough by the two of us, and there'll be no need to bring it to any further test. Because you'd never have granted it either from a lack of wisdom or an excess of shame, nor would you grant it to deceive me, you're my friend, as you say yourself. So truly, once you and I reach agreement, that will be the final word on the truth. And the finest inquiry of all, Callicles, concerns exactly what you took me to task about: what kind of man one ought to be, what one ought to practice, and how far, whether older or younger. Because if I'm doing something wrong in the way I live my life, know well that I don't go wrong on purpose, but out of my own ignorance. So don't give up now that you've started correcting me. Show me clearly enough what it is I ought to practice, and how I might acquire it. And if you catch me agreeing with you now but not doing, later on, the very things I agreed to, consider me a complete fool and never bother correcting me again, since I'd be worth nothing. So go back to the beginning and tell me again how you and Pindar say justice stands by nature. Is it that the stronger should forcibly take what belongs to the weaker, that the better should rule the worse, and that the superior man should have more than the inferior one? Are you saying something different from justice, or have I remembered it correctly?
That's what I said then, and what I say now.
And do you call the same man better and stronger? because even back then I couldn't quite grasp what you meant. Do you mean by stronger the physically more powerful, so that the weaker must obey the stronger, which is what you seem to be showing then, when you said that large cities attack small ones in accordance with natural justice, because they're stronger and more powerful, as if stronger, more powerful, and better were the same thing? Or can someone be better yet weaker and less powerful and stronger yet more wretched? Is there one and the same definition for better and stronger? Make this itself clear to me. Are stronger, better, and more powerful the same thing or different?
I tell you plainly, they're the same.
Well then, aren't the many stronger than the one by nature? And it's the many who make the laws over the one, just as you were saying a moment ago.
Of course.
So the customs of the many are the customs of the stronger.
Certainly.
And so of the better too, since by your own account the stronger are far better.
Yes.
So their customs are, by nature, admirable, since they belong to the stronger.
I say so.
Well then, do the many believe, as you yourself were just saying, that justice is having an equal share, and that doing wrong is more shameful than suffering it? Is that so or not? And mind you don't get caught being ashamed here yourself. Do the many believe, or not, that having an equal share, not more, is just, and that doing wrong is more shameful than suffering it? Don't begrudge me an answer to this, Callicles, so that, if you agree with me, I can take it as settled, coming as it does from a man competent to judge.
Well, yes, the many do believe that.
Then it's not only by convention that doing wrong is more shameful than suffering it, and that having an equal share is just, but by nature as well. So it looks like you weren't telling the truth earlier, nor accusing me fairly, when you said that law and nature are opposites, which I supposedly know and exploit in argument, twisting things toward law when someone speaks by nature, and toward nature when someone speaks by law.
This man will never stop talking nonsense. Tell me, Socrates, aren't you ashamed, at your age, to go hunting for words, and to treat it as a windfall whenever someone slips up in phrasing? Do you really think I mean anything other than better when I say stronger? Haven't I been telling you all along that I hold better and stronger to be the same thing? Or do you think I mean that if a rabble of slaves and assorted people worth nothing, except perhaps for bodily strength, gets together, and they declare something, that this then counts as law?
Well now, wisest Callicles, is that what you mean?
Certainly it is.
But my good man, I myself have long suspected that this is roughly the sort of thing you mean by the stronger, and I keep asking because I'm eager to know clearly what you mean. Because surely you don't think two men are better than one, or that your own slaves are better than you just because they're physically stronger than you. So tell me again from the beginning who you mean by the better, since it's not the physically stronger. And my remarkable friend, teach me more gently, so I don't run off and leave you.
You're being ironic, Socrates.
No, by Zethus, Callicles, whom you invoked yourself just now while being ironic with me so much, come now, tell me, who do you mean by the better?
The superior men, I mean.
You see, then, that you yourself are just uttering words and explaining nothing. Won't you tell me whether by better and stronger you mean the more intelligent or some other sort of people?
Yes, by Zeus, that's exactly what I mean, very much so.
So often, on your account, one intelligent man is stronger than countless unintelligent ones, and he ought to rule while they're ruled, and the ruler ought to have more than the ruled. That's what I take you to mean, and I'm not hunting for words if the one is stronger than the countless many.
Yes, that's exactly what I mean. That's what I think justice by nature is, that the better and more intelligent man should rule and have more than his inferiors.
Hold it right there. What do you mean by this now? Suppose we're all together as we are now, a large crowd, and we have plenty of food and drink in common, and we're all sorts, some strong, some weak, and one of us being a doctor is more knowledgeable about these matters, and as is likely, stronger than some of us and weaker than others. Won't this man, being more intelligent than we are about these things, be better and stronger when it comes to them?
Certainly.
So should he take a larger share of this food than the rest of us because he's better? Or rather, should it fall to him, as the one in charge, to distribute everything, while when it comes to consuming and using it for his own body he shouldn't take more than his share, on pain of harming himself, but should take more of some things and less of others, and if he happens to be the weakest of all, should get the smallest share of all, though he's the best, Calicles. Isn't that so, my good man?
You're talking about food and drink and doctors and nonsense. That's not what I mean.
Don't you mean by better the more intelligent? Say yes or no.
I do.
But shouldn't the better man have more?
Not of food and drink, no.
I see, perhaps of clothing then. And the most skilled weaver ought to have the biggest cloak and go about wrapped in the most and finest garments.
What clothing are you talking about?
Well then, clearly it must be shoes, or the most intelligent and best man in that line should have the advantage. Perhaps the shoemaker ought to walk around wearing the biggest and most numerous shoes.
What shoes? You're talking nonsense.
Well, if you don't mean things like that, perhaps you mean something like this. A farmer, knowledgeable and fine and good about the land, perhaps he ought to have the advantage in seed, and use as much seed as possible on his own land.
How you keep saying the same things, Socrates?
Not only that, Calicles, but also about the same subjects.
By the gods, you truly never stop talking about cobblers and fullers and cooks and doctors, as if our discussion were about them.
Then won't you tell me in what area the stronger and more intelligent man justly has the advantage when he takes more? Or will you neither put up with my suggestions nor say it yourself?
Why, I've been saying it all along. First of all, by the stronger, I don't mean cobblers or cooks, but those who are intelligent about the affairs of the city, how it might be well governed, and not only intelligent, but also courageous, capable of carrying out what they've conceived, and not giving up halfway through some softness of soul.
Do you see, excellent Calicles, that you and I aren't accusing each other of the same thing? You say I always repeat myself, and you blame me for it. I say the opposite of you, that you never say the same thing about the same subjects, but at one point you define the better and stronger as the physically more powerful, then as the more intelligent, and now you've come around to something else again. Some people are called stronger and better by you because they're more courageous. Come now, my good man, get it over with and tell me once and for all who you mean by the better and stronger, and in regard to what?
Well, I've already said, those who are intelligent about the city's affairs and courageous. It's fitting for these men to rule their cities, and justice consists in this, that they should have more than the rest, the rulers more than the ruled.
What about themselves, though, my friend, ruling or being ruled?
What do you mean?
I mean each man ruling himself. Or is there no need at all for that, for a man to rule himself, but only to rule others?
What do you mean by ruling himself?
Nothing elaborate, just what most people mean. Being temperate and in control of oneself, ruling over the pleasures and desires within oneself.
How charming you are, you mean the fools, the ones people call temperate.
How so? There's no one who wouldn't recognize that's not what I mean.
Absolutely, Socrates, and emphatically so. How could a man become happy while he's a slave to anything? No, this is what's naturally noble and just, and I'll say it to you now in plain speech. The man who means to live rightly should let his own appetites grow as large as possible and never curb them. And once they're as large as can be, he should be capable of serving them through courage and intelligence, and satisfy them with whatever they crave at any moment. But this, I think, most people can't manage. and that's why they run down men like that, out of shame, hiding their own incapacity, and they call self-indulgence shameful, as I said before, enslaving the men who are naturally superior, and being unable themselves to procure fullness for their pleasures, they praise self-control and justice on account of their own lack of manhood. Since for those who happen from the start to be sons of kings, or who are naturally capable of securing some rule or tyranny or dominion for themselves, what in truth could be more shameful and worse than self-control and justice for men like these men who could enjoy good things with nothing standing in their way? And yet they'd bring in as master over themselves the law and talk and blame of ordinary people. How would they not have been made miserable by the so-called nobility of justice and self-control, when they hand out no more to their friends than to their enemies, and this while ruling in their own city? No, Socrates, the truth which you claim to be pursuing is this: luxury and self-indulgence and freedom, when they have backing, that is virtue and happiness, and all the rest of it is fine talk, agreements among men that go against nature, nonsense worth nothing at all.
It's not without spirit, Callicles, that you press your argument speaking so frankly. You're now saying clearly what other people think but aren't willing to say. So I beg you not to give an inch anywhere, so that it may truly become clear how one ought to live. Now tell me, you say the appetites shouldn't be curbed if a person is going to be what he ought to be, but that one should let them grow as large as possible and provide them fulfillment from any source whatever, and that this is virtue.
Yes, that's what I say.
Then it's not right to say that those who need nothing are happy.
No, because on that reckoning stones and corpses would be the happiest of all.
Well, the life you're describing is certainly a strange one. I wouldn't be surprised if Euripides was speaking the truth in those lines where he says, "Who knows if living is really dying and dying living? Maybe we really are dead." I've actually heard from wise men before that we're dead right now, and that the body is a tomb for us, and that the part of the soul where the appetites reside happens to be the sort of thing that can be persuaded and swayed up and down. And so some clever fellow, a Sicilian perhaps, or an Italian, spinning a myth out of this, twisting the word for effect, named it a jar, because it's so persuadable and persuasible, calling the unthinking uninitiated, and saying that the part of the soul of the unthinking where the appetites lie, the undisciplined and leaky part, is like a jar full of holes, likening it to that because of its insatiability. So this fellow shows you the opposite of what you claim, Callicles, that among the dwellers in Hades, meaning the unseen place, these people, the uninitiated, would be the most wretched of all, and they'd be carrying water into their leaky jar using another leaky thing, a sieve. And the sieve, so my source told me, stands for the soul. He likened the soul of the unthinking to a sieve because it's full of holes, since it can't hold anything, being riddled by faithlessness and forgetfulness. Now all this is admittedly rather strange, but it shows what I want to show you, if I can somehow persuade you to change your mind, to choose, instead of the insatiable and undisciplined life, an orderly life that's content and satisfied with what's always at hand. Am I persuading you at all to change your mind, to admit that orderly people are happier than undisciplined ones? Or will you not budge an inch no matter how many more such stories I tell?
That's closer to the truth, Socrates.
Come then, let me give you another image from the same gymnasium as the one just now. Consider whether this is what you mean about each of the two lives, the self-controlled and the undisciplined. Suppose two men each had many jars, and one man's jars were sound and full, one with wine, one with honey, one with milk, and many others each with something else. But the streams feeding each of these were scarce and hard to come by, procured only through much toil and difficulty. Now the one man, once he'd filled his jars, would neither pour in any more nor give it a further thought, but would be at ease on that score. But for the other, though the streams could likewise be procured only with difficulty, his vessels are cracked and rotten, and he's forced to keep filling them constantly, night and day, or else suffer the utmost distress. If each life is like this, Do you say the undisciplined man's life is happier than the orderly man's? Am I persuading you at all by saying this, to concede that the orderly life is better than the undisciplined one? Or am I not persuading you?
You're not persuading me, Socrates, because the man who's filled up has no pleasure left at all. That's exactly what I was just calling living like a stone, once he's filled up, neither delighted any more nor pained. No, the pleasant life consists in this, in as much flowing in as possible.
Then isn't it necessary, if much flows in, that much also flows out, and that there be some large holes for the outflow?
Certainly.
The life you're describing sounds like a plover's, not a corpse's or a stone's. Now tell me, do you mean something like being hungry and eating while hungry?
I do.
And being thirsty and drinking while thirsty?
Yes, and having all the other appetites too, and being able to fill them and enjoy it, and live happily that way.
Well done, my excellent fellow. Keep going the way you started, and don't let embarrassment hold you back. Though it seems I mustn't be held back by embarrassment either. So tell me first, if a man had an itch and scratched it, and could scratch to his heart's content, scratching all his life through, could he live happily that way?
What an absurd thing to say, Socrates, you're a regular crowd pleaser.
Well, that's exactly how I startled and embarrassed Polus and Gorgias, Callicles, but you won't be startled or embarrassed. You're a man of courage. Just answer.
All right then, I say the man who scratches would live pleasantly too.
And if pleasantly, then happily.
Certainly.
Whether he's itching only in his head, or need I ask you more? Consider, Callicles, what you'll answer if someone asks you all the questions that follow from this one after another. And to sum all this up, the life of those who behave like catamites, isn't that a terrible, shameful, wretched life? Or will you dare say that these people are happy, provided they have all they need without stint?
Aren't you ashamed, Socrates, to drag the argument into subjects like that?
Am I the one dragging it there, my noble friend? Or is it the man who says outright that anyone who feels pleasure, however he feels it, is happy, and who draws no distinction among pleasures as to which are good and which are bad? Come, tell me even now. Do you say the pleasant and the good are the same thing, or is there some pleasant thing that isn't good?
So that my argument won't be self-contradictory, if I say they're different, I say they're the same.
You're ruining our earlier agreements, Callicles, and you won't be able to examine the truth of things properly with me any longer, if you're going to speak against your own real opinions.
Well, so are you, Socrates.
Then I'm not acting rightly either, if I'm doing that, nor are you. But my good man, consider whether the good really might not be simply feeling pleasure of any kind whatever. Because if that's how it is, then a great many shameful things turn out to follow, as we've just been hinting, and many others besides.
So you think, Socrates.
And do you, Callicles, really maintain this in earnest?
I do.
Shall we take up the argument then, on the assumption that you mean it seriously?
By all means, very much so.
Come then, since that's how you want it, make this distinction for me. You call something knowledge, don't you?
I do.
And weren't you just saying that there's a kind of courage that goes along with knowledge?
Yes, I was saying that.
So in saying that, you were speaking of courage and knowledge as two different things?
Absolutely.
Well then, pleasure and knowledge, the same thing or different?
Different, surely, wisest of men.
And is courage different from pleasure too?
Of course.
Come then, let's remember this. That Callicles of Acharnae said the pleasant and the good are the same thing, but that knowledge and courage are different both from each other and from the good.
And our Socrates of Alope won't agree with us on this. Or will he?
He won't agree, and I don't think Callicles will either, once he looks at himself properly. Tell me, don't you think people who are doing well are in the opposite condition from people who are doing badly?
I do.
Then if these are opposites of one another, isn't it necessary that the same holds for them as holds for health and sickness? A person surely isn't healthy and sick at the same time, nor does he get rid of health and sickness at the same time.
What do you mean?
Take any part of the body you like and consider it. A person has a disease of the eyes, called ophthalmia, doesn't he?
Of course. Correction, of course.
And surely, he isn't healthy in those same eyes at the same time.
Not in the least.
Well, what about when he's rid of the ophthalmia? Is he then also rid of the health of his eyes, and does he end up rid of both at once?